Oh. Zach, you can narrate if you want. This is Welcome to Rebooting the News. Unbelievable. This was the show I was sure would never happen. Doc, you there?
I am here.
Are you on?
Are you there?
Some manner of speaking,
I'm here. I am definitely on Skype, and I'm in a good Skype connection. So,
are you in a good mood, too? Good Skype mood?
I'm in a good mood. I'm in a good mood.
That's sweet.
Sure.
That's sweet. So, welcome back, everybody, to Rebooting the News. This is like after 4 weeks, I think, we haven't done one. It's been a long, long time, but we've been getting a lot of done. Everything's rusty, totally screwed up. You wouldn't believe. You don't even want to know. But we have a really interesting show, lots of stuff to talk about today. And I have with me my good friend from Cambridge. You're not in Cambridge, actually, are you, Doc?
No, I'm one town away.
What town? Oh, you don't want Bedford? Medford? Something like that.
I'm in Arlington.
There you go. So, Doc Searles, how are you doing? Hello.
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. We're waiting for the next snow here.
We are too here in New York, yeah.
Yeah, it's huge.
I missed the big snowstorm because I was in Utah and we didn't get snowed on like you guys did. But I'll tell you something. There's a perennial construction site on my street, and I thought they had moved on. This is what I came home to find out. Adrian's going to love this one. Come home, and they had the whole street had been repaved, and it was all beautiful and everything. Nah, it's all dug up again. welcome to New York. So,
civilization is always under construction. That's how civilization works.
That's a really good place to start, right?
Because
I read a blog post you wrote today, and it was I retweeted it, and then it was one of the most retweeted things I've ever done.
Well,
because it sort of hit a nerve, and the headline was you sort of stole the president's thunder there, and said that this moment right now is the Sputnik moment for the cable news industry. So, Doc, tell us about that.
Well, I think it's a Sputnik moment for all of cable, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I think cable news is a big part of it. But basically, cable has always been, from the beginning, you know, a one-way sluice that's controlled entirely by the supply side, and which is basically the entertainment industry. And they put devices in our homes called set-top boxes, and there isn't even a set anymore. Nobody has a set. What's a TV set?
What was a set? You know,
I mean, a set was a box, you know, and it was a tube. And
you could put a thing on top of it,
now,
right?
Now we have a screen. We have a flat thing we can put on the wall, and it doesn't even have a top. It has an edge.
Right.
These are obsolete devices, and it's an obsolete system, and it's been obsolete for a long time. And it's been inverted. They carry the internet as well, and they call that inside the industry over the top. If you're getting, say, Hulu or Netflix, you know, live, you're getting your stream from there. They call that over the top, and they're very threatened by it. And what they need to do is adopt it. They need to jump over that. And the problem is that, and this is what Al Jazeera brings up. It's been kind of pro forma for a long time for them just to ignore the fact that Al Jazeera exists. And the fact that it's actually quite a good news organization, and what's happened in the last,
Before you go on, let me ask you a question. Why is it that we don't get Al Jazeera on our, you know, the 500 channels that we get? Why isn't one of those channels Al Jazeera?
I don't know for sure.
You don't know?
Maybe
okay.
Another call. I think it's just been, like I said, it's pro forma. I think there are two reasons, and this is my thinking. It's not what I know.
You can move on if you don't know. I mean, you were on a roll there. You had a story you were telling.
Yeah. I was
curious about that.
I think they had their reasons, and the reasons were specious and wrong. And now, you know, now we're in a situation where if you want good coverage of what's happening in Egypt, which is by far the most important thing happening in the world right now, you've got to see it on Al Jazeera, and it's not on cable. And that's the, you know, and Jeff Jarvis correctly called for cable to start adding it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my comeback for that is, well, why even bother with cable? You know, you can get it on your iPad, you can get it on your iPhone. You can't get it on Android yet, as far as I know, but maybe somebody else can correct that. I can't tell. but for those who are equipped with either of those devices, you can watch on the phone, and for that matter, you can watch on your laptop if you've got, you know, if you've got one of those. It's, there are workarounds, and those workarounds are looking more and more like, you know, TV used to.
Yeah, but you wouldn't even know that you could do that if you, unless you were on Twitter, which, you know, for me, it was incredibly frustrating. I was in Park City for the last 6 days in Utah, and all we got was, well, the internet access was awful. I mean, it was really, really slow. And on the TV, all we got was two versions of CNN headline news, which I hadn't realized had all turned into Nancy Grace and missing children reports. You know, it's like endless interviews with mothers screaming and crying, you know, where's my kid, and Fox News. And so I was left watching, and so was, you know, everybody there. I was talking with people on the plane back yesterday, and lots of them coming from Park City for the Sundance Film Festival, and everybody was basically watching Fox News for the first time, and it was really...
Because they had no choice.
We had no choice. It was the only source of video news. Then I'm back here, and the contrast, now I'm on my Fios network here in New York, and I'm watching Al Jazeera, and I cannot believe what I'm seeing. It's far superior to...
Does Fios have Al Jazeera?
No, I'm getting over the internet. I'm doing it like over the top. This is over the top, you know. And I can echo
right.
your
You're
sentiment.
Get over the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The set top box.
You're not aware of the bottom. You know, it's like TV's the bottom.
I don't really feel like it's the bottom, but or the base or whatever. My TV, my set top box can't even do HDMI output. It has an HDMI jack on it, but I plugged it in, and all you get is a green screen. I looked it up on the net. And they said, yes, it's a known problem with the Motorola, which is the one that everybody has, set-top box. Can't do HDMI. Funny. Yeah. It's like...
I used to have one of those with Fios before we got rid of it, and it did do HDMI. So maybe that's a temporary problem.
So you had Fios, but you got rid of it. Why?
Well, we have Fios. We still have the top.
Oh, you have the bottom. Okay, you got rid of the bottom.
We
don't have
the cable. It comes by fiber to the house, and then... It splits between what they actually call POTS for plain old telephone service, which is landline or fake landline, and cable. It actually says cable TV, and there's a coaxial cable that goes out, and then another one that's an Ethernet or a cable output that goes to a router here, and that's for internet. And like you have got 25 megabits symmetrical each way, and for $64.95 a month, and. And we used to pay like over $100 to also get the cable TV box, and the cable TV box is something we hardly ever watch. And so we just decided, for the sake of, you know, saving money, to get rid of it, because we mostly cared about movies, and we could get that with Netflix and get what we wanted for the most part, rather than waiting for it to roll around at HBO. So, you know, so we got rid of it. But while we had it, it did have HDMI out, and it worked quite well.
Really?
In fact, I was quite impressed by the picture.
So you were suggesting that they should unbundle, the content should unbundle and presumably make themselves accessible over the internet for a fee. I mean, it would be, I totally agreed with that. I would be willing to pay, you know, whatever, $20 a month for HBO maybe. I mean, HBO plus Showtime. That gets me all the programming, maybe a couple of sports channels, so I can watch the World Series and the NBA playoffs and, you know, the March Madness and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, I'd be glad to pay for ESPN. I'd be glad to pay for HBO or maybe Showtime. But even within those, I'd actually like to do that at an a la carte basis. Like, I don't want to see everything on HBO. I don't really see everything on some of these others.
Right.
And I'd be willing to pay more on an a la carte basis. But they've been opposed to a la carte from the start. And what they're being undermined by now is the fact that the world is an a la carte place, basically.
Right.
And you tend to get these bundles where somebody has control of the pipe or whatever the conveyance is to, you know, between production and consumption, and they can control it and they can shove this other stuff in there. But but what Al Jazeera shows is that, like, here's the one damn thing that we really need right now if we care at all about what's happening in the world, and it ain't there.
Right.
And it brings up what's wrong with the system, which is the system is blind to everything but the its own exhaust. And, you know, so they've missed out. And it's an entertainment system. It's not a news system. It's, you know, the headline news that demonstrates that. You know, I remember, you would too, I suppose, that, you know, the headline news used to be this handy thing. It was like, nothing but news, like the hard stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. No, it did used to be useful, and, right? You want to get caught up, and they were playing something on CNN proper that was not interesting to you, so you switch over there, you get the weather report, stock report, a little bit of sports, you know, some politics, and then it repeats every half hour. Of course, it was useful. I can't believe that they did this to it. You know, it's, it's like the whole thing. It's like reality doesn't really intercede into our world, at least according to what the corporations are willing to let us have. You know, I heard a scary thought from Simon Johnson, who is, was at Davos. He's an economist who blogs at Baseline Scenario, and I read him regularly. And so he answered a question that I had been wondering about, is why all the talk in Washington about the problem with the budget deficit, right? Because, you know, according to Krugman, who I believe in pretty, you know, tells the truth, you know, the deficit, and I know from my own experience, if you're making an investment that, you know, has growth potential, like buying yourself a college education, that it's worthwhile running a deficit because you get the payoff later on down the road. So why all of a sudden is the budget deficit such a big issue? And he said it's because the banks want to make sure that our government's balance sheet is in good shape when they need the next bailout.
So
in a sense, we're all just here playing a part in the sort of big picture that's run by the banking industry, that's run by the by the defense industry, the oil industry, pharmaceuticals, medical, the big industries, you know. So you watch a guy like Julian Assange, you know, stand up to this, and then you watch how they take their shots at him and try to knock him down. And in the same way, Al Jazeera is a really inconvenient thing for CNN and for the government of the United States. I mean, the government is going in a certain interesting direction. Read somewhere that the next Solicitor General that Obama has nominated is a former lawyer for the RIAA. So that gives you some clue about where we fit in. And, you know, he wants to get reelected, and he needs the media, the American media, to cover for him. Although, you know, I keep wondering, you know, Jonathan Glick asked a great question on Twitter today. John is an ex-CTO at the New York Times and a New York-based entrepreneur who I think we both know. At least you've emailed with him, right? And he said, right, well, if Tunisia is Poland and Egypt is the Berlin Wall, who's the USSR? And it's kind of an interesting question.
Right. And where is the, and where have we been? You know, I mean, saying, you know, there has been no Bush, Bush kind of did it, but there's been no Reagan on this side saying Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. I mean, in an indirect way, I don't think it was the right thing to do, but when we invaded Iraq, at least there was this noble cause for restoring democracy there. You know,
Really? You buy that, Doc?
Yeah,
you of all people?
I'm looking for the single example that we might have that we gave any message that was pro-democracy other than supporting Israel.
I don't really think we are pro-democracy in this country. I really don't. I think we use Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I didn't mean to step on
it
there.
Oh, no, we have a latency thing here, but you're the guest, so go. Guests go first. Doc, you're never going to get it this good for me again.
Well, I agree with you. I think we have forgotten what democracy is about here to a large degree. It's turned into a show. It's turned into a show that goes on every 2 or 4 years.
Yeah, and we feel really big because we write blog posts and tweets and stuff like that, but you watch the Egyptians standing on the bridge taking the water cannon, and you go, well, do you think Americans would do that? I mean, I think that we're awful soft. I don't think we really are prepared to stand up, or maybe some of us are. I don't know. You know, a lot of people said Saudi Arabia was the USSR, but I don't think so. I think that the world financial system is the USSR. I think that's what we're looking at right here, is that we are being awfully controlled by these people, and there are not very many of them either. And we also have the tools to inform ourselves about what's actually happening here. The same way, you know, that everybody wanted to give credit to Facebook and Twitter for this revolution, and we're all sort of grappling with that point of view. And the answer is those are brands like NBC or, you know, Whirlpool or, you know, Exxon. And what's really happening is that we have much better information flows now, much better ability to communicate with each other. And that is sort of the opposing force. That's the set-top box is a regulator that keeps us from being too well informed.
Right.
But
right.
Could the United States, well, could they invoke the kill switch and get away with it? That's, you know?
In the U.S.? I don't think so.
Well, they couldn't in Egypt, right? It didn't work, right?
No, it's not gonna, I don't think it's going to work. I don't think it would work here either. I really don't think, I mean, even if it's being contemplated at some level, which I'm sure it is.
Oh, there's no doubt that it is. If I were sitting in there, I think if we were sitting as, you know, flies on the wall inside of the halls of power in Washington, they would be asking the question right now, should we hit the kill switch now before it's too late? Because things are happening pretty quickly.
They are, but I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think it's a good idea in any case. I mean, it's pretty hard to imagine.
No, it's an awful idea.
Any circumstance other than, I mean, let's say, for example, and maybe somebody's doing this, you know, like, you know, apparently our government or the Israeli government or maybe both was behind the worm or the virus that brought down the Iran nuclear facility a couple months back. And I mean, let's say somebody, you know, some terrorist organization, you know, Al-Qaeda or something, wanted to do the same, figured out how to infect Cisco switches all through the internet in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and was in a position to do that. That's the kind of thing that I would imagine might be worth contemplating a kill switch for, but then you'd have to work it with those switches. So I just don't see it happening. I mean, trying to imagine it out doesn't make sense to me. You know, and as for the
Well, you know, let me ask you a question, since you don't have, sure. since you can't imagine that. How, you know, and this is, would you have been able to imagine the Egyptian government flipping the switch? Because a lot of people say they can't, couldn't imagine it. Fred Wilson said he couldn't imagine it. Fred Wilson from Union Square Ventures here in New York. I found that so hard to believe that he couldn't imagine
it. Well, I mean, I suppose, the equivalent of thing in the U.S. would be the United States government going to the duopolists, okay, going to Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and Cox and Time Warner Cable and saying, shut those things down now.
Don't you think they would be all too happy to do that? I don't think they would. I have to disagree with you. I think they would be jumping up and down and saying, well, we were waiting for you to do that. Because once the precedent has been set, I mean, those guys are the same guys who own all the content that they want to pump up the prices on, and they want you to buy the whole package, Doc. I mean,
I know they do, but I just don't see that happening.
Okay. I hope you're right. it's not a very nice thing to contemplate.
You know, they've got an autocratic dictatorship going on in Egypt, and they can pull that off. I don't think they can pull that off here.
Really?
I think it's in the interest of the U.S. government to keep business going. You know, this is the land. You know, as the Onion puts it, this is the land of opportunism, and that's really what we support. You know, I mean, even if the intergalactic financial system.
Oh, so is China, right? Isn't China the land of opportunism too? And you got to know they have a kill switch, right?
They're certainly tied in with it, but it's the land. It's really the land of manufacturing. You know, they're everybody's factory. I mean, if you're going to be—I forget what the joke is that the Onion has for China, but here I don't see that happening. I mean, and what I said in my post really is pretty much confined to what happens to cable, because you know, cable is in trouble, and you know they're probably aware of that.
But more than cable, is in trouble, Doc. I mean.
I know. But
I watched the interview with Julian Assange last night on 60 Minutes, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing, that the interviewer was basically representing. He was almost like cross-examining him as if he were the prosecutor, the Solicitor General for the United States government. You know, let's paint this guy in the absolute worst light, and let's keep asking him the same question over and over again, see if we can't get him to, you know, yell at us or bark back. And you know, and I was thinking while they were doing this, is like, geez, all the questions they were asking him boil down to this: please explain what a journalist does. You know, and mm-hmm. and the question presumably was being asked by a journalist, somebody who not only fully understands that. And 60 Minutes, like him or not, I always felt was a bastion of journalism. You know, Mike Wallace.
I don't know.
No, you didn't buy that?
Well, Mike Wallace was himself a prosecutor every single time he went on there.
I know, but he was. But he, I felt he spoke for us, though. I mean, the things he exposed really did piss me off, you know?
They've played gotcha for a long time. That's basically has been 60 Minutes.
Yeah, that's true.
Position from the beginning. I'm not saying what the guy did. I didn't see the show.
What about the Times, Doc? I mean, you know, they have this thing about Assange. I mean, they're attacking him personally. And, you know, the Guardian ran a story saying that he dressed like an old woman for 2 hours. I mean, you know. The Times gave him a hard time for helping Bill Keller use Excel. It's like they're picking at this guy, you know. I mean, that's when I say there are other parts of that whole media thing that are in trouble. This is what I'm talking about. It's like they have to try to put somehow build this wall around themselves, that the safety they used to have. And in the fits and starts, they have the opposing force of all this great information now being available that can do things like topple, well, admittedly, an 83-year-old despot. That's what we're talking about. And it shouldn't be too hard to get rid of an 83-year-old guy, right? I mean,
I got to say, just as an aside, that guy looks great for being 83 years old.
Well, I got to say, you're right.
His hair is painted on there. I don't know what the deal is. But, no, I hope I look that good when I'm 83.
I know. I was thinking, well, my dad didn't make it past 80, so, and I remember what he looked like in the last few years, and he did not look as good as old Mubarak does.
Yeah, well, Mubarak's old enough, I'm telling you. You know, they may have some of that, you know, they probably have a pyramid waiting for him, you know.
Let's hope they do, and it would be really nice if he took a graceful exit here. You know, that's the other thing I'm looking for, as I'm wondering about, as the looting became an issue, is it possible for these countries that are living under dictatorships to transition to something better without destroying themselves in the process? And I guess Egypt gives a lot of hope there, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things that I've seen on Al Jazeera is that there's, you know, it does seem to be, from some of the complaints that people have, you know, a nation of businesses, a nation of shopkeepers, as was once was said, I think, about this country. You know, we have ordinary people there that are trying to get by and are selling stuff to each other and trying to make food move and the rest of it, you know, while they're busy trying to, you know, take down a corrupt government. And it's kind of such an interesting thing to watch, because there are these flywheels of civilization that are not just about the government. They're about commerce. They're about civilization. And civilization is more than just what the government controls.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. It's an interesting thing to watch, and I find myself having some degree of hope and faith in the Egyptian people to just, you know, take this thing down, put something else up, and go about their business without bringing down the rest of the world with it. Which I don't think is going to happen. Actually, I think that
Well, it'll be a really incredible example for all the world, really, if they could do a transition here without completely destroying themselves.
It really would. And I kind of sense that between the lines with a lot of these folks, you know, that there's, hey, look, we're just, you know, I'm just trying to feed my family here, one guy's saying, or, you know, I'm just trying to find where I can pick up some food. I'm trying to find my suppliers. I'm trying to find this and that. And they've turned the phones off. They've turned off other things that people need in order to do business.
They played a lot of dirty tricks on these people, didn't they? I mean, but they did, and
you know, you don't, in a democracy, you can't do that, and that's the thing. It's, you know,
but we're inching step by step. We're inching into that place where we're constantly having dirty tricks played on us, Doc. I mean, the bailouts, all those bailouts that the government did, you know, and the fact that that we're now basically, you know, rebuilding the same system that needed all the bailing out, you know. Have you seen Inside Job?
No, I don't
Charles
have it.
Ferguson
I want to see Inside
you
Job.
Gotta
I'm,
see
I'm reading.
It.
I'm reading a book I want to tell you about, but it's in the bathroom right now, and I'm hooked up by earphones to the computer, so I can't really walk with it. But it's the Griftopia or something like that. It's by this guy from Rolling Stone. It's really great. I mean, it's really well written, and it's.
What's it called again? What's the name of the book?
I think Griftopia or something.
All right, we'll put it in the show notes. Let's find out.
Yeah.
I read The Big Short by Michael Lewis.
I read that too.
That was an eye opener, especially towards the end, when you really
it's
understand. Pardon me.
Griftopia.
Griftopia.
Griftopia. Bubble machines, vampire squids, and the long con that is breaking America. And the guy doesn't pull any punches. This guy's Matt Tite.
Well, I think that's the reality. I think that we are, you know, getting a lot of diversions, a lot of things that make us look in the wrong direction, and that what's really happening is, and Johnson, Simon Johnson, I mentioned earlier, to his credit, he pointed us right at it. He said, understand how much the banking industry is controlling the United States. It's not a good thing, you know. I want to switch gears a little bit here and ask you about something that I think you probably have some opinions about, and we're talking about a lot these days, which is this idea of educating the journo programmer. You know, so here we are sitting, and right now I'm sitting in a journalism school at NYU, and uptown at Columbia, they're contemplating the same thing, and it's not just discussed in the context of journalism. Wendy Seltzer, who I'm sure you know at Harvard, is talking about teaching technology to lawyers, and it's the sense that, you know, we're so deep into the web now, you know, 15 years later, and it's not, you know, showing any signs of, you know, going away, that now the question is, what kind of lawyers and journalists do we want to actually, and presumably every other profession too, do we want to turn out, and how do we teach it? And I wanted to throw something out, because I've been spending a lot of time thinking about this and writing about it, and I'm going to, of course, keep writing about it too, is that my sense is that what we need to do in sort of a big picture is go back to the role that the universities used to have in technology as being the incubator for the technology, the place where the new ideas hatch in a non-commercial context, strictly as tools for human beings to communicate, and then make those ideas available freely to our students when they graduate and to everybody else, to then go create businesses out of those things. But that the fundamental, you know, basis of the technology is open source, is available freely to everybody. And, And sort of like going back, you know, we had this experience here at NYU with the Diaspora Project that sort of booted up out of nowhere. All of a sudden, everybody's throwing Kickstarter money at these four NYU undergrads and saying, here, go, you know, do Facebook, but do it open. And it was more a wake-up call than anything, saying that not only is there interest inside of the student base to do this, but there's also interest amongst the people. The only parts that have not gotten clued in on this are the commercial software world, Silicon Valley, and, you know, its various instances elsewhere, such as New York, for example. And then the university itself was kind of shocked by this and didn't really know how to react. So the question is, coming back to this, is now, you know, how do we go about doing this? But that's how I view it. And I'm throwing this out there and saying, you know, what do you think?
Well, I think that there's several things. First, I think that we need to get journalistic tools in the hands of individuals. And this is something you've been doing your whole life, and it's embodied in the name Userland, which you came up with, 20 years ago. And that's, to me, that's the basic thing, and that's what blogging tools were, that's what outlining is, that's what outlining always has been. that's what, you know, the river concept and so many other things you've come up with are basically about. You know, let's put in the hands of individuals the ability to do, you know, journalistic things, to write journals, to hook them together, to syndicate, to do all these things. That's A, and I think that we just need to keep working on that. And that's, and I'm all for doing that, and I want to help every way I can. The other thing with it, at the institutional level, is I don't even know if they're how capable they are of doing that. I think with some programs like Jay's at NYU, where you've got a guy like Jay, you know, running at least part of it, you know, there's some level of institutional awareness, even if it's just in one faculty member, in the fact of the complete, you know, diasporization of journalism, of, you know, out of institutions and out into the general populace, and the equipping of everybody with tools by which they can communicate with anybody else. And that's, you know, I don't know to what degree institutions can cope with that. Last weekend, I was in Boulder, Colorado, at the University of Colorado, where they're getting rid of their journalism department. You know, and just in the face of what's going on, the whole idea, as I understand it, and I didn't probe it deeply, but the interesting thing is they're basically getting rid of it and scattering its pieces into other departments, and in recognition of the fact that what used to be journalism and then the way we understood journalism just isn't there anymore, and isn't something that's easily taught or even worth teaching. Is, you know, it's a different situation. We live in a different world. It's not, you know, it's like trying to bring the French court to, to a jungle or something. It isn't going to make any sense. It's a new ecology. And the ecology is one that everybody can contribute to. And,
well, that's the point. Why disband something that everybody is going to be doing or everybody is doing? See, that's the thing. It's so depressing to me to think that a school like University of Colorado would do that, because it's like, well, I think everybody needs to learn that basic stuff. Maybe not 4 semesters of it, maybe 1 semester of it, you know. But I would like to see everybody get a basic journalism education, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I don't think that they're saying they're giving up on journalism. I think it's actually an encouraging.
I see. Okay. Like, well, then I think it's great. I think that's the way to go. That would not be a very popular idea where I'm saying it.
I know.
But on the other hand, I would be very surprised if... I don't know if any of my colleagues here listen to this, so I'm not so worried. I know Adrian is laughing when I say that. The engineer. I think you met Adrian, right?
Yes, I have. To me, it's, you know, it is rebooting the news. I mean, you know, that's what we're doing.
We're
debugging it. And the thing is that we've got, it's pure open source in that sense. You just have a lot of people patching it and coming up with new code and patching that. And some of it's behavioral, and some of it is binary, some of it is actual computer code, but an awful lot of it is just practice.
I think it just needs to be reconfigured. I mean, there's so much stuff that has been sort of developed in the commercial world. I know, because that's where I've been trying to root myself for my most of my career. And then what happens is, things get bought out. I mean, you remember what happened with Moore, right? I mean, we finally reached the ultimate of outlining, I mean, or what felt like it, and our only option really was to sell the company. I mean, there really wasn't any other option. And then what happens after that is nothing. The product goes away, and you can just forget about it because it's almost as if it didn't happen. Which, you know, it's terrible, actually. And so, what's the answer to that is to go back to what worked. And what worked. And so then maybe what's happening is that, and it is at its core journalism, right? I mean, when you reconfigure, if the university becomes, and I don't mean like any particular element of the university, because I don't think you could say that a department could. I don't know if you can hear that, Doc. There's telling us that. Yeah, we're going to ignore that. We're going to go for another 10 minutes, okay? Doc, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Yeah. That it wasn't a department at the university that created Unix. It was actually not even a department at a corporation that did it. It was sort of a loose association of people in various different institutions. And that's why I think that's also a very important aspect of
seconds.
It, is that it needs to be cross. I mean, we need to not think of ourselves as being in competition with each other, rather think that we have a very limited resource, you know, and that largely is our students. The small number of them that are motivated to actually, you know, make a contribution to their own future and create something that has value that can't be sold to a company and therefore dissipated, you know. I mean, that's the thing to watch out for. I mean, when you look at what venture capitalists do with their products, or investors, or guys like me running a software company in the 80s, you know, we have very different objectives than the society as a whole has for creating these communication systems. And it's so I think that having an effort that comes from the point of view of, well, as we said, the users, right? That and who are the users if not the young people that are coming out of universities, right? You know,
I think there's some symbiosis that we're trying to find. By we, I mean a bunch of different constituencies at the same time, and you know, that includes the students, the faculty, and institutions like that, the VCs, the established companies, the independent developers like you, you know, sort of half-time academics and you know, writers like myself, are all trying together to do several things at the same time that to some degree are in conflict and or in terms of trying to find the resources. And so, for example, right now, there really is a little bit of an investment mania going on. There are a lot of new startups. They're soaking up an awful lot of the programming talent. I speak almost every other day with somebody who's saying there's a real shortage of programmers right now. They're all being soaked up by the startups. The attraction there is getting hooked up with a startup that may get rich and quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the motivation with that is not running a great business. It's flipping a business, as you just mentioned.
Yep,
with,
yep.
That's what happened with Living Video Text back in the Pleistocene.
Right.
You know, but it's the same game now. It's not, you know, I told this in Clutrain, but it really bears repeating. And I was at a party in San Francisco way back in the 80s or something like that. It was the late 90s. It was the late 90s. And that's when everybody was wearing black and had goatees, you know. And I can tell you that this wasn't Evan Williams. It was a party that Evan was at, and it was at Jerry McCulkey's house. It was in San Francisco. And there was this kid I kind of half knew, and I met him at a couple other parties, and he was like at his third startup. He isn't even 30. And I asked him, you know, so what are you doing? I said, oh, we got a new startup. And I said, what do you do? He says, we're an arms merchant to the portals industry. Portals are an industry? How's that? And I pushed at him. And he said, and he had every cliche in the book about what they were doing at the time. And I can't remember what all of them were, but they were the same kind of jive that social and influence and all that crap is now, right? And
well, it's like credit default swaps. Those are, you know, they're creating the hybrid products or the collateralized debt obligations.
Well, right,
which
that's Wall Street jive.
Well, but what do you think the Wall Street is? It's just another instance of the computer.
Let me finish.
Okay, sure, of course.
It's an instructive story, and it has to do with Wall Street indirectly. And it's when I finally asked him what I thought was a rude question. I asked, how are sales? And he said, they're great. We just closed our second round of financing for $25 million. And what I realized at that point was, holy shit, every company has two markets, one for its goods and services and the other for itself. And that what had happened in Silicon Valley was that the market for the companies themselves had overrun and stripped the gears of the market for actual goods and services. And the idea was you sell your company, not that you actually have anything worth selling to customers. And that was a distortion, and I think that distortion is around again right now. I think it's around advertising. I think it's around media. You know, I think it's it's certainly there in Facebook. Nobody's even talking much about, wait a minute, you know, here's a company that has $750 million in sales, and its founder is called the youngest billionaire ever. Well, why is he a billionaire? Well, it's because he sold some of his stock on private markets. What are those private markets? There's a little bit of talk about that, but it's all speculation that this company is going to cash out huge soon. Well, you know, how is this, you know, it's all kind of Ponzi-ish and on the come, and that's a little part of it. There's a much bigger set of games going on in Wall Street, but it's a similar set of assumptions where the value of what you're doing is in gaming a system and not in actually delivering much value to real customers.
Well, there you go. I'm glad you raised the customer there, because that's where I'm coming at it from, is that, all right, you've got all these Ponzi schemes that are designed about to create these huge customer base or user bases, right? And then when they finally pay off for the people that have been creating them, what are we left with? Well, we're certainly not going to get that, any part of that upside, right? I mean, that's not, the dollar upside isn't for us. We're not getting that. What happens to the stuff that we've been creating? I finally came up with a way to explain this to the journalism people, like the New York Times, which promotes Twitter like you wouldn't believe. I mean, every time Twitter turns in a slight direction, that's a major story for the New York Times. They don't like Julian Assange, right? That's very clear, but they love Twitter. And I asked the question, is like, why do you like Twitter so much? Because they're every bit as much a threat to you as Julian Assange is. And I said, how could I explain this to these people? Because I come from Silicon Valley, right? And I know how these board meetings go, right? And I said, this is how I'd explain it, Doc. I'd say, you are to them as a contributor to the letters to the editor is to the New York Times. I met the letters to the editor guy at the Times, and my mother writes letters to the editor. So I know both sides of that equation, right? And he's a great guy. I'm not taking anything away. They really do care about their users, right? But when it comes down to it, they're only going to take one sentence out of your email, out of your letter, and you're going to write 90 letters, and only one of them is really going to stand a chance to get in there. Now, he knew my mother's name, which I thought was pretty amazing, and so he obviously had been reading her letters and stuff like that. But when it comes right down to it, the rest of the New York Times says, well, fine, we've got that guy there, and it's his job to make sure that we are actually paying attention to these things. The vast majority of the attention to that organization has nothing whatsoever to do with what's actually going out over the wire in that dimension. Same thing's true at Twitter. Same thing's true at Facebook. They don't have the attention, the ability to care. And so when they move, you might say, well, they would never do that because that would screw us and they depend on us. No, they don't. All they care about is the aggregates, the slurry of it, how can we average this stuff out and so present the case that we're worth, you know, $100 for every user that we've got so that when we go public, we can get rich. And after we've gone public and gotten rich, it's somebody else's problem. And who is that person who ends up, you know, with a problem? Not a very nice person. So that's one of the other reason why we need to do something here is to protect our own interests, which really are counter to the interests of the companies that are sprouting up here in the technology industry. I think you can factor all of those out. You know, sure, a large number of our students are going to end up going to work for startups, you know, but some of them, and maybe it's a very small number of them, but you don't need a lot of them, Doc. I mean,
I'm working with some right now. It's great.
Right.
They want to do the base level stuff that can be leveraged into many different purposes.
Yeah.
You know, they want it to be, you know, they want power to be distributed. They want to make, you know, they want to make the building materials that everybody else can use to build whatever they want. And then once you've got that, then you can build other things.
That's what I'm talking about. And then you turn it all over to the users, and it could be the very same people that, you know, because they're going to be out of here in at most 4 years, right? And then they can take it and they can do with it. Maybe they can sell some of it to the VCs. Maybe they, whatever happens with it. But it should be a continual process. And, you know, we might as well start it now. I know that when I was a CompSci grad student, there was nothing there. We had to create it for ourselves. And it's no better today than it was then. So I'm saying that's really where we need to there's a real opportunity there to put some focus on that. Yeah, I thought you would. So, cool. Well, I think, Adrian's spinning his finger right now. He says, what, five, four? We don't really run that tight a ship, but I know you're a radio guy, Doc, so you can appreciate that. Hey, Doc, I'm looking forward. I'll see you this week on Thursday in up in Cambridge.
Well,
And totally look forward to that. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.